This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
Noted. I'm literally making a note right now. I've got to do that.
And Brock Rom.
How I'm, you know me, I'm ready.
I promise you've seen Kevin Foy's work. You maybe just didn't realize he was the one behind the lens. Kevin is the chief videographer and engineer for the Chicago Bears, and has behind-the-scenes stories for days of some of the most iconic moments in sports over the last 20 years. Sit back, grab some bourbon, and enjoy the show.
Let's clap on 47.
Boom.
Absolutely unbelievable.
I missed it.
No. Never better.
All right, you're off the podcast then.
And JP's gone.
Good talk. Glad we did this.
And you're talking to me.
I said Andy's gone.
You know why I thought you might have been in the office? Because I saw that person behind you, and that person's your reflection in the mirror.
Oh wow.
It wasn't up there before, but my wife has wanted a full length mirror for a while, so I broke down and got it for her, and our bed is right here, and that's really the only place for it. So as I was putting it up, I was trying to push it further over so it wasn't right behind me. And
hey, you look like you're in an office now.
Yeah, the more we did it, I was like, this is really the only spot for it, so I'll just deal with it. So
that's
all
funny.
Good.
I had not noticed that in our earlier go. I see you waving.
The downside is that people can see my other screen. So if I ever want to peruse online or something like that, I use my primary screen over here.
Nice.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack, so if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Today we're joined by Kevin Foy, who has been with the Chicago Bears for 17 plus seasons as a videographer and engineer. And he's one of the few people who I know who has covered multiple iconic moments in sports. And I think we'll get to some of those and talk a little bit equipment and evolvement over the course of your career there. But you just got back from a vacation down in Kentucky, and I know you're really big into whiskey. So I thought that might be a good place to start, you know, just to whet people's appetite here.
Yeah, let's talk bourbon.
Yeah, so pretty much the wife and kid usually go over Christmas, but, you know, in football, you can't do that. So I'm stuck here in Chicago working and doing my thing. So at the end of the season, you know, you work so many days in a row, you just got to just let loose somewhere. So last year, I took off and actually met my wife in Seattle last year, and we went out to Vashon Island and had a nice little weekend. But then I took off to Whistler on my own for snowmobiling and whatnot, and then caught a Vancouver Canucks game, watched the Sedin brothers actually retire with their big ceremony, just lucky enough to be in town for that night. But this year we did it again and went to Kentucky for bourbon. Went to see my parents in Pennsylvania. You know, I haven't seen them in a while, so I had to kind of get that on. Take care of that. And then once I left there, I went on wild, wonderful West Virginia to get down to Kentucky. But there was a reason for it, though. There's a distillery down there called Smooth Ambler, and they're clear down in Maxwelltown, West Virginia. I mean, almost to the bottom. And so I looked at the routes to get there, and, you know, 79 out of Pittsburgh is the fastest and probably the smoothest. And there's another route on the other side of the mountains in Virginia. But I'm like, you know what? I'm going straight through the Appalachians. And so I took two lane roads the whole way down. It took about 5 hours. There was not a straight part of the road anywhere. Once I got to Maryland, it was windy. And then, you know, once West Virginia, it was up and down all kinds of hills. But finally got there, and it was a great place to stop for the first stop. Any of you guys ever had Smooth Ambler? Old Scout.
I have not had Smooth Ambler. I am a very amateur bourbon and whiskey aficionado, but I know friends who are very into it. And I do have to ask, are you part of the weird gray Facebook market that like sells specific barrels of Four Roses that come out that they then go and try and find the barrels around it because they really like certain barrels?
I don't get that crazy. I'm into some of those Razzle sites, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's usually about the extent for me, because, you know, I don't know what I'd even do with a barrel of whiskey.
it's a wild world, not one that I'm part of, but I've glimpsed into it a little bit, and people are crazy about bourbon.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you could just see it. Just even, you know, being down there in the middle of January when I got to Lexington, Kentucky, and hit all the big four. I mean, there was packed with people everywhere you went.
Yeah, my introduction into bourbon was on my 21st birthday, and there's one kind that I just can't ever look at or hear about at any point. But I think, you know, my one of choice is Angel's Envy. Otherwise, I stick a little bit more. I'm Maker's Mark 46. I like that, those kinds, a little bit lighter on the proof.
Yeah, I mean, you could find some really good stuff out there that's, you know, lower proofed from a lot of different bourbon distilleries. The two you picked were good, but I think there's a lot more that are better out there.
I'm open to be educated.
Well, start with Smooth Ambler, for sure. They have a five-year single barrel out right now. If you're lucky enough to find it in your store, you'll see it. They usually have 10, 11, and 13 year too, but they're a little bit harder to find. When you get to the Lexington area, Wild Turkey makes some really good stuff. Kentucky Spirit is a really good one. Look for Warehouse G if you're looking at those bottles, if you're lucky enough to have a few picks from that. That is, they say that's the best of the bunch from that one. Buffalo Trace, obviously, with Blanton's and, you know, E.H. Taylor, and you can go on and on and on with those guys. Then you look
you're drinking it straight up. Or how are you drinking it?
I drink it neat. Yeah. I just put a little dab of water in it. Sometimes if it's lower proof, like below 100, I won't put water in it sometimes unless it really, really is calling for it. But, you know, anything above 100, I usually always just a dab or two. And then obviously Louisville, you got your Angel's Envy. Old Forester is a good one. There's a lot. Everybody overlooks Old Forester, and they really shouldn't, because, you know, Their cheapest, I don't know if it's their cheapest or not, but one of their bottles, the 100 proof, is only $22. But I was just at a taste testing about 4 or 5 months ago, and it went up against $150 bottles and won. It won.
That's wild.
Yeah, and people just kind of overlook Old Foresters. Like, well, that's what my dad and granddad drank. I'm not drinking that. But, you know, they have some really good stuff if you really know where to look.
Awesome.
But yeah, bourbon, man. And then you could go to Indiana and go to the MGP stuff. There's a whole list of stuff from that place too. So, oh, and if you ever, here's a little one too, that if it's a small company, but it's hard to find, but if you find it, buy the heck out of it. Boone County. They make 1833 10-year, 12, 14, and then I believe they're straight up small batches, a mixture between 5-year and 14-year barrels, which is really good too.
The only reason I know where Boone County is in Indiana is because that's where we got our two West Highland White Terriers. There's a breeder out there in Boone County. So,
well, this would be Boone County, Kentucky.
Oh,
a
little bit further east.
Gotcha.
You don't get to edit that out.
Yeah, I don't. Well,
yeah, south of
Cincinnati
there. Yeah.
I'll have to check that out. Got a basically sister-in-law in Cincinnati.
Oh dude. And then you need to go to the distillery and get hooked up straight from the source.
Noted.
Yeah.
I've got time coming up in Cleveland and Columbus, but not Cincinnati. Everywhere else in Ohio, but
some good
maybe
spots.
One of those Columbus trips. I'll have to make a little trip down.
It's not too far. Hour and a half. Yeah. I've made that drive before.
There's some good beer stops in that area.
Great beer stops in Columbus.
Cincinnati's got some good beer. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I mean, both. I've been really impressed with Columbus beer. I mean, it feels like this is a little off topic, but, you know, a sports creative podcast wouldn't
be complete
without talking about
alcohol. It's our podcast. The topic is whatever we want it to be.
Alcohol.
Well, I mean, just blowing off steam, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is.
Everybody's got to relax a little.
Yeah. I'm here for it. I'm not saying we stop. We could just go a full 60 minutes on.
Listen, I'm telling you, I could take this all off the rails. We could go beer. We could go whiskey. I could talk about Kevin's Telecaster and Gold Top Les Paul behind him there for a while too, if we want. You know,
there's a few more back there too.
Yeah, we could not talk a lick of sports production. Ooh, a little black like studio telly. It looks like, and that like a Kramer or an Ibanez. That's an Ibanez.
That's one of those Ibanez RG550s.
Yep,
I call it the poor man Steve Vai model.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the handle. It doesn't have the handle, right?
No, it was 1988, and I was almost. I think it was 87, maybe Zekatoris, but. I almost cut one into it, but I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, Steve Vai really revolutionized how you carry a guitar.
No kidding.
Just never had a handle before that. Who would have thought?
Nope. You know, normally when we nerd out on equipment, we stay within the broadcast realm, but we've just reached a new level of nerding out on equipment. We're just going guitar. I love it. You know,
now we can go down tube amp and the revolution of amp modeling and how good it's getting with impulse responses and stuff. But now
I totally agree.
I digress.
Yeah, it's audio. All audio,
it
right?
It is audio. You're not wrong. You know, and I've said it before, but really one of the things that set me on a more technical engineering path is when I was in college. I'm not going to digress too much here, but I helped run a recording studio with some friends. There was an old TV station in Lincoln. The owner passed away, unfortunately, and the landlord didn't know what to do with it because it was set up like with a control room and a studio space. And he was either going to have to spend, you know, five figures to remodel it, or we came in and we said, we'll rent it for $500 a month and turn it into a recording studio. And really a lot of that signal path is what set me on to understanding video signal path, because it just gave me the basic understanding of how to get signal from one place to another, to another, to another. So really a lot of my audio side, it's a reason I still have a bunch of musical equipment, is from that time of when we were running that studio. It gave me a really good base when I got into video. I already understood the audio side, cause I had kind of self-taught myself that before. And it took half the equation out of it for me, and gave me a basis for the other half.
You should become an amp modifier.
I don't want to kill myself. Yeah. Those transformers, that's too much voltage for me, man. I'd die instantly.
I bet you could find some new wicked sounds, though.
Just tweak it until it sounds good.
Yep.
All right. So
what a transition.
He doesn't know where to go.
What a transition.
Yeah. You know, we talked about blowing off some steam and how, you know, how you can work through the full season really without many days off. And this year in particular with COVID, there's even more requirement there because of the testing, right? So can you just walk us through a typical season? I think one of the things that stands out to me from my time in the NFL and working with you is the training camp and how that kicks everything off for three straight weeks. When I was there, we were down at a college campus, spending a couple weeks there, and you know, it was a long haul, and every day, you know, 14-hour days working and shooting and editing and turning content around.
I'll say this: we're now back up at Hallis Hall with our training camps now, but I miss Bourbon A, the college campus, because where is it any better than when you can wake up and out of bed and you're right at work? You don't have to drive there. You don't have to. I mean, there's good and bad, I guess, with that both, but it is just so nice. You know, your meals are there. You don't drive anywhere. You just get on your golf cart and go where you need to go. But yeah, this year was kind of crazy, man. I mean, wake up, you'd have to go in and report in sometimes as early as 5:30 in the morning to get your COVID test. It usually averaged around 6:30, 7 o'clock, but sometimes it was earlier. And yeah, you'd work, especially training camp. We did this big production mini series, and it turned out that I was pretty much shooting 90% of it, because I was the only one allowed to go in the office because of the tiered systems and whatnot. So we only had one person in tier two, is what they called it, which is kind of tier one's players, coaches, and whatnot. And then tier two becomes the secondary people. But yeah, I mean, dude, 5:30 to 9 at night was it happened almost usually three times, four times a week. But we worked through it. And then once the season started, we got two more people into the tier, and that helped a little bit. But then, you know, towards the end of the season, the NFL cut it back again because of the numbers jumping up. And then for the last month and a half, it was just me again, doing, you know, walking into a game, having to do social media, having to do photos, having to do what I do. It was insane.
Well, and I mean, just for people who maybe aren't familiar with kind of your role and your background, like, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what you do with the Bears and, you know, what a day to day looks like for you, you know, in a normal year, maybe a little less so than in a crazy pandemic year?
Yeah, I'm pretty much the chief cinematographer there. So I kind of guide the rest of the shooters. We have three or four other guys that'll shoot on like a 12-man team. But on a daily basis, you know, you'd go in and production starts usually on Wednesdays. You're cleaning up from the game Mondays and Tuesdays, mostly, you know, creating things. But Wednesday starts the production process again. And you do sit down interviews with players and or coaches, break that stuff down. You'll shoot interviews if need be with other people editing that sort of stuff. Then Thursday, Friday just becomes basically either still shooting if you couldn't get anything on Thursday, but mainly edit days. And then once you get through your edit days, Thursday, Friday, you kind of have a little bit of a reprieve Saturday going into the game, whether it be home or road. Home, you're off. Road, you're traveling. And then Sunday is the crazy day, man. And you just go in. And so we mic a player up every game. And so that's my main responsibility going into each game, is to get that player mic'd up and whatnot. And get ready for the game and shoot all that. And then once I get back on Monday and Tuesday, edit that down.
And what are you guys outputting for? I mean, is it like a show on, you know, linear? Is it all for social? Like what does your output look like when you're putting all that stuff together?
There's a lot of platforms. We have our game day and game night shows on Sundays. Not necessarily all of that goes to almost 80% of it used to go to that. But nowadays it seems like we've pushed way back because there's more of an approval process to get stuff out now and just to turn it around for that television show. And, you know, we'll push the envelope sometimes and get stuff out that was a really iconic moment in a game or something. But yeah, we'll push it out. And then, you know, YouTube's a big one, Facebook, Instagram, they've got Snapchat going, Twitter, you name it, it's going somewhere. And thank goodness we have a social media department, because, you know, it's crazy the amount of content that, you know, a team shoots nowadays. And there's no way with our 4, 5, 6 person staff that we used to have, we'd ever be able to even accomplish it. We would never be home. We'd be working from, you know, sun up, sun down.
I mean, how have you seen that evolve? You've been there, I mean, 17 years, I think you said at the beginning of this. Obviously that's, you know, a lifetime in as far as how things move with social media and like distribution platforms. How has that changed over time? You know, like you said, that you used to do a lot more for linear and for TV that now goes to digital. I mean, how do you stay on top of that? How do you adapt, you know, with the time? I'm 34 and I've been in the industry 10 years and I feel like it's changed insanely since I've started. How do you stay on top of it on your end?
Well, I mean, the one thing I always made us try to be on the edge of is at least going out of SD to HD and then HD to 4K. I figured out somehow how to get us there. It was not always, you know, the latest and greatest and most amazing equipment, but it got us in the door and it got us to where we were able to create in those resolutions. And it, obviously your video, you know, you look at it now. I mean, I was shooting on a Beta SX back in 2003, and you look at and that you thought it was the greatest thing in the world when you were shooting on it, but now you look at it and you're like, oh my god. Especially, you know, going back in, I spent the last couple of seasons digitizing a lot of those games for to save off and whatnot for the cloud. And yeah, I mean, it was painstaking it was cool to watch some of that stuff because, you know, you shot it. But yeah, but it was like, whoa. But then HD, you know, that helped a little bit. That got us, you know, into the door and being able to do a lot more cooler things. That's when we really started to mic players up and whatnot and get a little bit more behind the scenes and kind of try to give the fans, you know, something they haven't seen before, the behind closed doors stuff. But yeah, then 4K came and now it's a storage nightmare.
I mean, that's such an interesting thing to like that balance of, you know, shooting what you need versus trying to store a ton of 4K. I mean, like you have this ability now with everything being digital that shoot. And it's not an issue of like, you're going to run out of tape or run out of film on the front end. It's that trying to store that all and go through it all on the back end becomes the issue. Like that's just, I think that's the thing that transitioning from SD to you know, and then tapes and, you know, that kind of format to digital, I think, is made so difficult is just, you have to be more thoughtful maybe about how you shoot, how much you shoot, because access is king and you have more of it now, but trying to store it and go through it becomes a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah. What is your guys' storage solution? Because I know that's a hot topic on everybody we've had on the podcast when we talk gear is storage solutions and higher resolutions. What are you guys doing, Kevin?
We're EditShare. We've got it up to almost 600 terabytes now of usable online right in the office. So that helps because you can keep at least three seasons on there at one time. But we're now to that point where we have to find a cloud-based solution to everything we have. And we're starting to research into all that right now and figure out which direction we're going to go. But no, EditShare has been really good. I mean, it has its limitations like any other, you know, storage system, but you know, for what we do, it works. I mean, it's nothing, you know, different than a lot of others that are out there, but.
Right. In the end, storage is storage, right? Like there's hard drives and they're either, you know, on a SAN or a NAS and you share it out, right? It's just, how's your support, you know, and how's your user tools on top of it, right?
That's the key, is staying on top of that support, man, because I mean, we just had we didn't see it coming, but even EditShare just changed a little bit of their structure up with their support, and it'll help us out in the long run in the future. But you know, when you first see it and you're like, oh, why did my bill go up this much? But then they explain it and you can understand it a little more. But yeah, the key is with those systems, you know, a lot of companies now will only keep support for about 5 years on their equipment, and then it has to rotate out, which forces you to pretty much have to buy more. And so if you have, you know, 200 terabytes worth of storage drives sitting in a chassis and it comes under, you know, off warranty or off the support, and you're stuck. If you can still use it, but if it breaks, then
right.
Fuck.
Yeah. Anything outside of just replacing standard hot swappable hard drives, you're a little SOL.
Yeah, pretty much. That's why that support is so important.
Mm-hmm.
They really have you though.
On top of storage, I mean, the other thing that you have to deal with on that side of things is like the logging and the archive, like figuring out where stuff is. How do you guys manage that for, you know, a group that probably shoots as much as you do with the Bears having, you know, that many people on staff?
Yeah. I mean, here's a good example. You know, when I come in from a game and the other guy that's shooting mic'd up with me and we come in from a game, we'll have shot between, 500 and a terabyte just from that game alone. And then we have to, you know, break it down, throw out what's not good. And most of the time we'll keep the entire reel for the season. But now is like when the Grim Reaper comes, and I always tell everybody, I just sent the text out yesterday. I know you guys hate me this time of year, but it's time to start deleting. And, but yeah, we'll go through and we'll, if it's folder structured, that really doesn't work very well for, you know, especially when you start storing things and into the cloud and whatnot, which is what we're about ready to go to do. So we strip it down to just, you know, naming the actual clip itself, unless it's a red, you know, camera clip, which right. is important not to strip that out. You know, most of the stuff that we've shot on, we name the clip directly and just throw it in there and be as concise as we can. Dollar signs for the highlight clips and whatnot, dash signs for audio or, you know, whatever you come up with, but it's a painstaking ordeal, but you know, it works.
I think like the number one thing I miss, and it's probably the only thing I miss from P2 days and P2 cards, and that whole system, was marking clips as you shoot.
Yeah.
Cause I remember it made it really easy. We would mark at the Chiefs when we had our HPX 3000s, they're 3000s. You'd mark clips M for money and T for trash. And at the end of each quarter, I just go through and delete the T's. Right. Yeah. So everything I brought back was only money. And that's a feature I think more of these newer cinema cameras. And I understand why they're not necessarily focused on the ENG type market that would use that type of curation quickly. But I think that's a feature that I would like to see come back in a lot of modern cameras, is that ability to kind of like do a little meta tag and do some pruning on your own inside the camera subsystem.
I've figured it out. You shoot the grass for 1 second,
Oh, we do that too. Yeah. Or we put bars up. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's easy too when you only have two money shots, right?
That's one of my favorite freelance stories. I have a freelancer that works with me that does Monday Night Football, ENG for ESPN. And that's what he said. Like, they would send him out and he'd come back with right when digital first started, when it was all tapeless and people were just used to going through reels and reels. And, you know, when he learned that, you know, I'll just delete clips as I go, he'd come back with, 15 minutes of just like the greatest scenics of all time in those cities. And, you know, the producers and directors just thought like, oh my God, this guy doesn't waste a shot. He's incredible. And it took him a full season before he ever let him know that he was just deleting as he went. And, you know, half of his stuff was trash like anyone else.
That's funny.
Yeah. I think people who shoot games take that for granted. It's so easy to have that mentality of like, I got to keep everything. Right. But, on a shot when you missed a follow, or your ISO didn't work out or nothing. Even when I was shooting a Mira recently, I would shoot the grass or I'd put my hand over the lens, and black it for like a good shot. But even my bad shots right after it happened and in between the play and I wasn't shooting anything, I just go back and delete the most recent clip because it didn't make sense to me to keep it on there when I had the time to just sit there and delete it real quick.
Yeah. No, it would be nice to be able to do that right in the field and not have to worry about when you got back.
You guys are shooting a lot of micings, which I think that content is so valuable for NFL teams, especially with the characters in the NFL. What's your process like on that? I know JP early on alluded that at one point in time, or maybe you still are, miking and shooting with a 1DX, which is unique. What's that process for you like for you guys now?
So that gets us into that 4K realm with what we're doing at a cheaper cost. And what we do is we hook a Atomos up to it, and the Atomos brings in the audio, and it's on a 1080p reel. The Atomos brings in the audio from the mic. And so if you had to turn something around at the end of the game, you can be very quick about it. But when you get back into the studio on Mondays, then you match up your 4K from the 1DX. So you're basically double shooting the game in a way, but I think it's worth it with the look of the shot and even where we have to put some of this stuff, even in the building itself with some of the video boards and whatnot, and wall boards, that you really need to have that 4K to cover the aspect ratio, what they got going on in the building and so forth. But no, it's pretty cool. I mean, the 1DX, I think it has a great picture. It really does. It looks amazing when you shoot it. And we shoot everything in 4K 59.94 just so we can slow it down and post if we have to. And, when it comes down to it, you're really only saving the mic'd up sections of the 1080p. The rest of it just gets trashed and you're saving that 4K for your video, however you want to manipulate it from there.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask is how are you combining when you were talking about how there's two people shooting, you and one other videographer are shooting a mic'd up. I'm assuming that you guys are rolling quite a bit of the time, because a lot of times when the players are talking, the important stuff is in between the plays and not necessarily as much the plays themselves. So are you doing like a free run and doing a sync, or are you how much of that are you doing in the back end and trying to get the clips together? Because essentially if you're shooting on an Atomos, you're also shooting on the camera, and then he's shooting on it, or she is shooting on a camera. So how do you bring that all together?
It's all shot. I always send the text out to my buddy right before the game, check the world clock, time of day, time code. That's the easiest way to do it. Then when you come in and post, I already know that the way it's set up now currently with my camera, my 4K shot will be 5 frames off from the audio. So I slide the 4K video 5 frames before the audio starts, lay it down and just go from there. It's as simple as that. It's not that hard. Like I said, and with him being on time code, same a day, I can match up a shot of mine from his, even say if he didn't even name his clips yet, all I got to do is just look at the time code in the bin, and then I can find that shot pretty quickly.
So I think one of the things in working with you is that I always remembered you having, you being the person who also took care of the equipment. So if something broke, if you could fix it, you would fix it without sending it out, using a screwdriver having extra stuff in your desk drawer and some of those kinds of things. Obviously, with all the different kinds of equipment that you've used over the course of the years, how has that changed over the course of your career?
Yeah, cameras for sure. You got to send back if they break. There's no, it's just too, you know, delicate of a situation there. And you know, everything is so precise in those things that you can't like get in there and start messing stuff around. But now tripods, I'll give it a shot still. I'll still try to fix and do whatnot. And, you know, there's always gaff tape too at the end of the day. Gaff tape
and audio too, right? The wireless mics and like just the surface elements.
If they ever get messed up, ripped or whatnot, I'll try to resolder the ends and whatnot to those. But beyond that, if the transmitter itself gets messed up, I usually send it back too. Just because it's, you know, it's such intricate stuff anymore. It's not like just, you know, what it used to be, simplified in the inside and you just did what you did. But
I think you had briefly mentioned it, how things have evolved from SD to HD to now you're shooting in 4K. I think maybe it's a good time to go back and start talking about some of your iconic moments that you've captured. And the first one that I've heard you talk about multiple times is one based around practice back in Philadelphia. Can you give us a little bit of a background? Everybody has to have seen the Allen Iverson presser by now. Can you give us a little background into that day? And did you obviously probably didn't know what you were walking into or what you were about to shoot?
Not at all. I was over in Voorhees, New Jersey, shooting Flyers practice, and just got done talking with, I believe the last person we talked to was Mark Recchi. And I was on my way out the door and driving with my reporter, and we got to the Walt Whitman Bridge, coming across the Walt Whitman. And all of a sudden I got this call and the assignment desk said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm coming across the Walt Whitman. We're coming back from Flyers practice. You can get here as fast as you can. Allen Iverson just called an impromptu press conference." I'm like, "Okay." So I got in the door and he goes, "Don't even take any equipment down. Just run down. They're setting equipment up for you right now." I'm like, "What's going on?" Because he called an impromptu press conference, and you know, he's there. It's because the Flyers or the Sixers just got knocked out of the playoffs. They had lost, I believe, the night before. And so I went down and
this is when you were at CSN Philadelphia working at the network?
Podcast Sportsnet Philadelphia.
Okay.
So yeah, so I ran downstairs and the office was in the Wells Fargo Center at the time, which is, I don't even know what it's called anymore, but the hockey and basketball arena. And so I ran down to the area where they do the press conferences and walked in, and he goes, "Dude, you're here. Run this." And I'm like, "Okay, what's going on? When's this supposed to start?" And blah, blah, blah. And they said, "It's going to start probably within 5 minutes. So I was the only one, myself and another guy who now lives out in Seattle, Scotty McLaughlin, were the only two shooters in that room at the time. And he so happened to just be, he worked for the NBC affiliate there in Philadelphia. And he just so happened to be at the arena shooting something else and caught wind of this going on and just went in and shot there with me. But yeah, we were the only two outside of a bunch of news reporters and, you know, paper reporters and whatnot, the only two shooters in the room. And boom, that happened. It was crazy. Never saw that coming. Franchise player. I'm talking about practice.
I think everyone who's been around sports for, you know, more than 10, 15 years has that memorized and can do an impression too. I think that's the key. Everyone has their, we're talking about practice, man. Practice.
If you look at the stretch of that though, he was the MVP of the league the year before. And then the following year, it went to that, you know, they were okay floating throughout the season, made the playoffs, but then got ousted, I think, round one. And then the whole practice thing came up. And then it turned into later in that summer when he was accused. Well, I don't know if he was accused or not, but there was talk that he was, you know, busted into an apartment and brandished a gun or whatnot. And then next thing you know, they're taking him into the roundhouse in Philadelphia and arresting him. I mean, you're looking at a guy that was like way up here. Whew. And I was like, I don't think I'm ever going to cover a guy like this ever in my career beyond what I just saw in the last, you know, year. It was insane. how high to low that dude carried himself.
And I think it's important, and I think it lends itself to the thought process that any cinematographer, videographer in sports is a historian, right? Any moment at any point in time could become a part of sports history that's bigger and beyond yourself, right? So you got to shoot it in a way that lends itself to that, right? Because you just never know what shots are gonna blow up, what's gonna happen in front of your lens, and you know. So I've talked about it on this podcast before. I think, you know, treating some things as if you're a historian is important, because you definitely are sometimes.
Yeah, and here the crazy thing, you're exactly right though. You just have to always keep your eye open, and you know, whatever comes at you, you just got to document it down. I mean, I bet you all of us could probably write a book about something in our lives for as much as we've all seen. But the crazy thing with that Allen Iverson story at the end was his next door neighbor was M. Night Shyamalan. So when all these, we were all camped out at his house down in, I can't remember how to pronounce the name of the town he was in, but it was a real uppity scale area. And, you know, you'd see M. Night get in his car and drive down the lane while we're all camped out waiting to see if Alan's going to pop out of his house and whatnot. So it was a crazy time.
Wow. M. Night just waiting on the twist like everyone else.
Yeah. I'm surprised he hasn't made a movie out of it yet.
So you were in Philadelphia then. You came to the Bears shortly after that, actually. And a couple years later, they were on the way to the Super Bowl, and there was a game in Arizona that Denny Green famously said, "They are who we thought they were." And I've heard a couple of times from you about this story, because the Bears were down, I believe, 21-0 at halftime, right? Or 20-0?
20-0, I believe, yeah.
And they came back and won 24-23. Yeah, so that makes sense. 20-0. So can you give us a little bit of a background on that?
So we went into that game, and I think that was week seven of the year. In the first 6 weeks, I mean, we were putting up insane points with each game. The offense was really clicking and whatnot. So we're like, you know, going into Arizona, let's mic Rex Grossman. And it probably was one of his not so good games in his career, if you ever look back at it. But yeah, so we went into that game thinking that, and it was just, you know, everything just seemed to keep going sideways. And that whole first half was like insane. And you could just hear them over there talking and whatnot, and, you know, still pumping themselves up that, you know, we can do this, blah, blah, blah. But then we get to halftime, and I went in and I started shooting in the locker room, and I was shooting, you know, Lovie let me do a lot of things, Lovie Smith, and shooting in the locker room at halftime was one of them. I couldn't believe that we were able to do that, but, you know, we were documenting everything. And he always said, "I want everything documented, because if we win the Super Bowl, all this is coming out." And so I went in and, you know, was shooting in the locker room and shooting one of our coaches, you know, just tearing into the defense, you know, really saying this, saying that with an F-bomb, pretty much every other word. And I'm standing on a chair shooting, and all of a sudden I hear, "Kip, Kip, Kip." And I look over, and Lovie goes, so stopped shooting. And I probably got maybe all but 10 seconds, last 10 seconds of the coach doing what he was doing. And then it comes down to, obviously, then the Lovie brings everybody in, and I'm like, should I shoot this? Should I not? Should I shoot it? You know what? I'm just going to shoot it and see what happens. And so I started shooting Lovie doing his speech to the guys at the halftime. And that's when Olin broke in and did his speech and started really getting the guys going. And I just rolled on all of it and you know, went out the locker room, and that game turned out to be what it was. Came back in, everybody celebrating and whatnot and having fun. And I shoot all that stuff. And then we see the Denny Green thing on TV in the locker room. The players just erupt when they see that. And then after the game, when Lovie finally was free, I walked in and I said to him, I said, you know, just let me know if I ever crossed a line there. And he goes, "How much of that didn't you get?" And I said, "I shot it all, but about 10 seconds. He goes, "Good." And that was the last time he's ever said anything to me. He never stopped me on anything. He never kicked me out of any shoot. He never said I couldn't be here or there. I remember we had a game in Cincinnati where we were down 31-0 at halftime and basically kicked everybody out. Now, I walked out, but I could have easily had stayed in there and shot, and he wouldn't have said a word. That's where he was at with, on a level with me, was he wanted everything captured in case we won the Super Bowl, because he wanted all that to come out at the end of the season.
So much of it is based on relationships. How do you approach those coaching relationships? New coach comes into the Bears. What's that early time with you like to try and get that access, to try and build that rapport and get them to trust you?
I'm not going to lie. It takes about 2 to 3 years. It really does. It doesn't matter who it is, because I've been through, just with the Bears alone, I think 4 or 5 coaches now. And each time, you know, you'll get a little bit out of them at the beginning, because usually the PR department will help you out a little bit. And, you know, they're a lot closer to them early on than we are. And so they'll vouch for us a little bit. But so you truly get that bond. Yeah, you're always going to be kind of on the outside looking in for most things until that trust is built up. But yeah, usually 2 to 3 years. And then usually that third year is usually when you start seeing stuff evolve and you're able to do a little more and you're able to really get in behind the scenes, under the curtain, and what so to speak, and then go from there.
I just love those stories.
It's crazy, man. I'd tell you another good story that you weren't here to see, but I think is one of my top three shooting moments, was an Urlacher went into the Hall of Fame. That was crazy, because, you know, you're sitting in a hotel room with all his family and closest friends, and it's either that knock at the door and everybody's jumping up and happy, or it's the call and everybody's walking out of the room with very sad, pouty faces. And, you know, when we were in that hotel room in Minneapolis waiting for it that day, it was the Philadelphia New England Super Bowl that he got into it that Saturday. And there was a couple of players on his floor that, you know, you could hear him when you walked up in, all jubilant and whatnot. And then the people on the outside said, yeah, it was a pretty sad scene whenever, because everybody kind of just mass exodus the room once that call comes and they just leave. But yeah, to see him get in, man, and to be a part of that, to see Mr. Baker walk to the door and give him a big hug and talk to him, that was just insane. So it was a pretty cool moment.
Yeah. I mean, that between those three, I mean, you just upped it. I thought it was two, but those are pretty phenomenal.
I'll give you another one.
Experiences. I mean, go for it.
I'll make it quick with this one, but I had to cover the Subway Series in New York back in 2000. And I was basically the only shooter sent to go all 7 games. And whenever the last game the New York Yankees won, I believe it was game 6, I got on the field at the end for all the celebration and got into this mob of people trying to get a shot, where El Duque was walking around with the trophy, and there was so much push from all of the media trying to get the shot, and so much push from security pushing his back while he was walking around, that my shot was like shaky and whatnot. And all of a sudden I'm like, do I dare try this? And I just tucked my feet as high as I could up in and let the force of the media and the force of the security people pushing me lift my feet off the ground, and my shot stayed really smooth for about 4 or 5 seconds, and I got this great looking shot, and then I got back down because I got too scared. I was afraid eventually it would break and I'd fall to the ground. But
so you used people as a steadicam?
Yeah, pretty much, pushing on both
sides.
That's
brilliant. Wow, that's brilliant.
Crazy, but it was a cool shot.
That's awesome. I think those stories are a lot of the reason why I think a lot of people get into sports, is because they want to be part of moments, and opportunities to do that are there's a lot of grind in between those too, right? Like you shared 4 stories over the course of a 25 year career. And doing this stuff, ranging all the way back to the early 2000s. And I think one of the things that I've in shooting with you when I was in Chicago, we were the only 2 shooters on the field, which it sounds like has totally changed now. but I think I learned pretty quickly that how we could shoot together and complement each other. And I knew what you were doing and I could fill around that so that we could have some complimentary shots. And I just want to get your insight on how you think about and how you approach shooting with multiple people.
It's a lot harder now, just, and I'm not going to lie to you, just because, you know, a lot of these younger kids just want to prove themselves and show what they can do. So they're kind of more on their own, so to speak, than what you'd sometimes wish they were. I mean, I think with what we have going at the Bears, though, we're pretty good because, you know, we've got the two guys that are doing the mic, myself and my guy over in the other end of the field. And, you know, we're pretty tight with what we do and we know kind of what we're going to do and how we're doing it. Our web guy is really good at just capturing the moment, just standing out there and shooting the game. And then we've got specialized people running around the sidelines, just shooting, you know, celebrations behind the bench or, you know, those close up shot movements that you don't really get time to shoot when you're, especially when you're micing a player up. That's the hardest thing is, and I know you'll attest to this, Justin, but when you and I were working together, I mean, I felt like, you know, a lot of times before you got there, I had to do both. I had to do basically capture the game itself plus capture the mic. And it's like, it was really hard to like blend those two together. Now we got some really good stuff back then too, being able to doing that, but it was really, really hard. So having somebody else that can just shoot the game. And then a lot of times too, we lean on NFL films because, you know, we get the reels from them every week too. That helps a lot. But yeah, it's nice to have variety on the field finally.
Well, how did you first get into it? I mean, we kind of talked about all these stories, but like, you know, how did you get to that point? Where did you get into broadcasting in the first place?
I was still in college when I got my first TV gig and I was an on-air sports anchor and reporter and shooter. So kids would, you know, see me on TV at night broadcast or reporting on the sports if they were watching, and the next day it would be in class. But yeah, I started there in a little town called Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And we did some really cool stuff there. There was one little stint we did where we tried to recreate the movie Slapshot, where but I shot on this trip and then the weekend sports anchor went with me and we did a two game road trip with the Johnstown Chiefs and, you know, playing poker on the bus and whatever they're doing in the hotel rooms and blah, 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 and doing the games itself. It was a fun little trip, but we had fun back then. And then that lasted a couple of years. I think I did that from 95 to 99 and then was laid off because the sports industry, or at least the newscast there, went from an hour to a half hour. And so I was searching for a while and I was up for a news shooter in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I was trying to get into NFL films as the shooter for Pittsburgh. And a buddy of mine told me about this little company called Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia. So had the first two kind of going and, you know, was looking to getting a possible job in Scranton and shooting news just to get back into it and whatnot in May of 2000. And also had lined up where NFL Films was going to try me out in the preseason through preseason games. And then this Comcast Sportsnet thing came up. So I went to that. And as soon as I went there to Philadelphia and did the interview, I took the job immediately because I knew exactly that's what I wanted. And I was just shooting sports and whatnot. But the whole caveat and funny thing to this whole story is, so they asked me to stay that night and say, you know, stay with us. And I said, nah, I'm going back home. I'm all hyped. I just want to get home and celebrate and, you know, let people know, but then start packing. So, cause I got to turn around and get back down here. But when I got home back to the west end of Pennsylvania, the western side, at the top of my steps was a FedEx package from NFL Films. And on the answer machine in the door was my acceptance to shoot news for this station in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So it all happened in one day. It was insane.
That's wild.
Yeah. I mean, all this stuff you're trying to line up and all of a sudden it just all just populated in one day.
That's crazy.
And luckily, Comcast allowed me to shoot the NFL film stuff because a few of the games that I was supposed to try out for were Philadelphia Eagle games, two of them. And I'm like, well, how am I supposed to tell Comcast Sportsnet this when I work there now? And so I went into the boss's office and I said, what would you think if you could say you had a NFL films quality shooter on your staff? He goes, what are you talking about? I got this kind of lined up before I took your job. And he goes, yeah, go do it. I'm like, cool.
That's awesome. That's so key to have supportive people above you like that.
Yeah. Cause I mean, he could have just turned around and said, no, get out of here. But then Pittsburgh wanted me to shoot the games in Pittsburgh, or the NFL films wanted me to shoot the games in Pittsburgh. And I'm like, well, I kind of live in Philadelphia now. I can't do that. We don't need you here. We have an umpteen amount of people. I'm like, yeah, I guess that ship is going to sail. But hey, 17 years later, and well, more than that, 20 years later in the league, 17 years. So I'm not going to complain.
How did you end up in-house then? I mean, going from, you know, kind of the news and the network side to in-house, what led to that switch?
Just, they were looking for, you mean for the Bears?
Yeah. To come from, you know, the Sportsnet side into the Bears doing in-house stuff.
They were just looking for that quality of shooter that was, you know, able to capture what a network could capture, but on a team scale, because they just finished Soldier Field and made it, you know, into what it is today. And so with that job, you know, or with that became three or four of our jobs that our department had at the time. So it just kind of evolved from there. And I found out that after I had to hire some interns about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And so my boss gave me the database to get in there, and I started looking in, and he'd never deleted the database from when I got hired. And I found out that I went up against 177 people.
Wow. And I mean, that doesn't necessarily surprise me, but I mean, it's always when you actually hear the numbers and are able to see that, that's,
yeah,
it's wild.
And it came down to me. And then there was another shooter at Comcast Sportsnet Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. that came down to. And luckily they chose me.
Well, I'm glad they chose you, too, because I got a chance to work with you and appreciate everything that you've taught me. I think we have a couple people that have a news background, but really want to get into sports. I guess what would be your recommendation, whether it's creating a reel or finding an in to help them?
I mean, the biggest thing, especially if you're in like broadcast news or whatnot, and you're trying to get to that sports end of things, what I did was, you know, when they first hired me right out of college, I was a news shooter for maybe 3 or 4 months. But I always said to the sports guys, hey, you need something, let me know. If I'm not shooting anything for them that day, I'll shoot it for you. You don't even have to pay me, and I'll do it. And, you know, I wasn't making much there anyway. I was making probably $12,000 a year, if that even, at the time. But no, I always, you know, straight up made myself available at all times for anything sports. And I just got lucky that one day the news director got fired and the sports director said, we're going to act like you've been in sports this whole time. When the new news director comes in, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. And never went back. But I sat outside courtrooms a few times and waited for what not to happen, and then the reporter come out and you do their stand-ups. And I never got into the real crazy thick stuff, but I had a guy, a new shooter when I was working there, that would try to take me on these drug busts and whatnot. And I went on one of them, but I was too scared to get out of the car one time. But that was the last time I went. Cause they were issuing him like a real jacket to put on just in case something happened. And yeah, I'm like, well, I don't have one of those, dude. I'm not getting out of the car.
Yeah.
But yeah, crazy times.
I guess to end here, what would be your, looking back at your career, any suggestions or advice that you would give to people who are just getting, or are early on in their career, with the longevity that you've had over the course of your time?
You just have to be open to everything, depending on what you're going after. I mean, if it's sports, if it's news, whatever you're doing, man, just have an open mind and be willing to put in the extra hours, because I think that alone will get you a lot further than, you know, just wanting to be put into a box and say, no, I'm only going to do this, I'm only going to do that. That to me is the biggest thing. know your whatever you're getting into. Like if you're going to become a cameraman, know your cameras. If you're going to be, know the editing software, that's huge. Graphics nowadays as well. I mean, that's become probably one of the hottest things. Just knowing everything about what you're about to step into is the biggest key. I mean, a lot of it, I'm not going to lie to you, is right place, right time. Because I think all of us could probably attest to that, that, you know, we were just there at the time and it just happened and boom. Excel and, you know, step this up the next level. But that's to me, that probably be the biggest, is to just, you know what you're going to get into and understand all of it from every angle, and then just enjoy the ride.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.
During the pandemic, I got like weirdly into disc golf. So there's some good courses up in the North Suburbs.
Disc golf is the biggest thing at Beck TV.
It's a nerdy ass thing, and I'm totally okay with it. I got even into it on the broadcast side. Like they have like a pro tour that they broadcast on YouTube, like, you know, edited, post produced, like covered in the trade. It's fascinating. It's actually really well done.
We've got a disc golf practice hole outside of our office at Beck TV.
Oh, hell so. Yes. That's so awesome. Hire me.
Hey, man, if you can make a BNC cable, you're in.
I cannot. So there we go.
Then you're out.
I'm out.